This week on Art on the Air features Chesterton-based floral designer Chris Livovich, whose lifelong love of flowers began in Central America as the daughter of missionaries. Next, we have ceramic artist Thomas Harris, who works with traditional functional objects, then alters them to create unique sculptural forms. Our spotlight's on LaPorte County Symphony's concert with three Texas tenors and the Purdue Varsity Glee Club.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at LakeshorePublicRadio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available on our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our shows are available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for more information about upcoming shows and interviews. Art on the Air is now available on WDSO 88.3 FM Chesterton on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. And we'd like to welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight someone who's been with us many, many times before. Appreciate him always bringing us up to date on the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra. It's the Executive Director, Tim King. Welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight, Tim.
Thank you.
Sparkling Tim King.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, we're always glad to have you. You're always enthusiastic about what's going on with the orchestra and your last concert of the season. So it's going to wrap up. So tell us a little bit about that. You got some really heavy hitters on that one.
We do. It's been a whirlwind 50th anniversary. I can tell you that. It's hard to believe. We've been planning it for 2 years and here it is. And so the final concert is really what I affectionately call the blowout concert. The finale of the 50th anniversary. We're not going to have one guest artist. We're going to have two guest artists. And so we are going to open the concert. It's Saturday, April the 22nd, 7 p.m. Central at the Civic Auditorium. You can get tickets at lcso.net. They're all $30 a piece in the balcony. The floor is sold out. But what we're going to do is we've had a fanfare that's been commissioned, which we've played a few times during the year, called Celebration Fanfare, commissioned by Gary and Joe Fran Bendix. And Joe Fran is celebrating her 50th year with the orchestra with us. And so Rick DeYoung, who's conducted us quite a few times, did this fanfare. And it's a wonderful opening piece, a great opening piece, 2-3 minutes. And then Carolyn's going to come on and conduct the Candide Overture, which is a really wonderful, uplifting, difficult, but great piece. And then the Purdue Varsity Glee Club, under the direction of William Griffel, is going to join us for the rest of the first half. We had the Purdue Varsity Glee Club back in April of 15, and other than Holiday at the Pops and Who's Your Star, it was the best-selling concert we've had in the last 10 years. Wow. You just find out, you know, of course, we live in Notre Dame territory, and I understand that, but there's still a lot of Purdue folks here, a lot of Purdue folks, and they're just as fanatical about their associations as Notre Dame is. So they're going to join us on the first half. They're going to do 3 or 4 selections of their own without the orchestra, and then they're going to close the first half with 2 selections that were orchestrated just for them and us to close the concert. So it'll be a really nice first half. We'll have an intermission. We're going to sort of have to reset the stage, and we'll be welcoming the Texas Tenors. For people that don't know who the Texas Tenors are, all you have to do is Google thetexastenors.com. They have a huge following, and I will be the first to admit I was not familiar with them. They won America's Got Talent a few years ago and have made a couple of appearances with them again. They are in demand. If you go to their website, you will see the list of their performances coming up. We're just lucky to get on the slate, as far as I'm concerned. They're playing with the Louisville Orchestra on April the 8th. They're playing with the Augusta Symphony on the 20th. They're going to play with us on the 22nd. They go to Texas on the 23rd. I mean, they're just all over the place. So they're doing a program called Broadway and Classics Remembered. And so it sounds sort of like a greatest hits sort of situation. Fortunately, I'm going to get to hear them in advance, doing the same program a couple of weeks in advance of ours. And I'll be able to come back home with some good knowledge about what their program is like. But they have this amazing following. We've already sold tickets from 8 states.
Wow.
And that just gives you an idea of of the people that follow this group. And, you know, the Purdue Glee Club has their groupies and the Texas Tenors has their groupies. And so the two groupies are going to reunite for the first time on this particular concert. So I think it's going to be just an amazing evening of really good music performed really well. And so and what a great way to finish the 50th anniversary. I probably will be in an asylum the day after, but, you know, it'll be worth it to get through the evening. And it will be a super evening. I really want people to come out. And for $30, you get the orchestra, you get the Purdue Glee Club, you get the Texas Tenors. Where else can you find a bargain like that?
That is. And you're still at the Civic Auditorium.
Civic Auditorium in La Porte.
And that's kind of the last event. Aren't they going to renovate as soon as you guys are done or almost there? They're going to work on something?
That's the plan. The Civic Auditorium is going to put in central air. Of course, they would do that when I leave, of course. And then they're going to redo all the seats in the balcony with cushions. And so it's going to be just a wonder. Supposedly, our Hoosier Star event next September will be the first event after they have done all the renovations. So we'll be able to take advantage of all those wonderful renovations when we come back.
Fantastic. And the Texas Tenors have three. I kind of like their listing because I did go to their website. One is listed as the tenor. One is the contemporary tenor. And the other is the romantic tenor.
Well, they've all been classically trained. That's the thing that amazed me about them. I've seen their resumes. They're classically trained, and they can do anything from pop to opera to country, you name it, it's there. And so I think that's going to be really appealing to a lot of different people.
Well, you mentioned this, and we'll let our audience hear that you're wrapping up your tenure as executive director. And I think I said off air, but I'll say it on air, is that you've really turned around much about the orchestra there. You brought in a great conductor with Carolyn, and the whole organizational part, I know people have told me, is wonderful. But and before we wrap up and tell us the dates and everything again, tell us a little bit about your plans after being executive director.
Well, my plan, I'm going to be leaving July the 31st, so I'm still here for a little while. Hopefully we'll get a new person in and I can spend some time with him or her that will be here. And I'm still going to be, you know, I'm not going anywhere. I live here. I live in La Porte County, and I want to be involved as a volunteer. I've been helping with this a la carte fundraising series during the summer ever since I first moved here, and I'll still be doing that. And I've gotten really involved in the whole planned giving aspect. So I'm going to be working with Lee Morris, who's a very, very well-known person around La Porte County, and we're going to be working on the planned giving efforts for the orchestra to ensure the future.
Excellent. Well, remind us of the dates and location one more time for your final concert.
Texas Tenors and the Purdue Glee Club with the orchestra, La Porte County Symphony Orchestra, on Saturday, April the 22nd, 7 p.m. Central, at the Civic Auditorium in La Porte. Tickets are $30 for the balcony, and there's general admission, and it's lcso.net.
Well, that's outgoing executive director Tim King. We appreciate you always coming on Art in the Air Spotlight and informing us of everything that's going on.
Yeah, congratulations on the 50th.
Great. Thank you so much.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the full one-hour Art on the Air program on Lakeshore Public Radio is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art in the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
Hi there. This is Public Radio theme composer B.J. Lederman, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Chris Lipovich to Art on the Air. Chris is a flower girl from the beginning. Her family encouraged her passion for flowers. Now, Chris is the owner of the dynamic Sugarfield Flowers in Chesterton, Indiana. Her style is fresh and modern with an unconventional elegance. Thank you, Chris, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. This is like the perfect conversation for spring. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, how we always like to start our interviews out is to find out a little bit about you, your whole, I call it, origin story. And so I always like to set it up like how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us the story of Chris.
Sure. Well, as Esther said, a flower girl from way back. I grew up as a missionary kid in Mexico, although my very early years were in Guatemala, which is sometimes called Land of Eternal Spring. So it got me into flowers very early on. There's endless pictures of me and my siblings with our noses stuffed in a flower where our dad was making us smell the beautiful bloom. And I just loved them from the beginning. You know, I loved the different regions we were in, from tropical to arid to desert even. You can find beauty there. And my parents were very accommodating. We traveled quite a bit as missionaries. We drove from Chicago to Mexico and back again, and they were always wonderful about allowing me to stop and pick flowers along the way. In my bio, we do talk about there being flowers drying on the dashboard. I would often have flowers strung from coat hook to coat hook, you know, the little coat hangers in the cars. I'd have those strung on strings.
Chris, when I was growing up, we did the dandelion crowns and daisy chains. So what were you doing? What flowers were you, did you do that with a variety of flowers?
We did a lot of dandelions. In the region I grew up in, roses grew very, very easily. So I was endlessly stringing rose petals and just making big, long dried potpourri strands that I would hang in my room or wear around my neck just for fun. So that was how I started with flowers and just continued in my teenage years. We would go into Mexico City and to renew passports, and my parents would take me to the flower market, and I would bring my bundles home on the bus and just arrange them in the house, filling as many containers as I could. It was a lot of good practice for what I'm doing now. In college, my very first year of college, I started working at LaSalle Flowers in Chicago, which is an institution of its own. It's been around since the 40s, owned family business. I started working there and realized this was something I could do as a profession, and essentially dropped out of college right then and started in my job. My boss encouraged me. She sent me to a flower academy where you learn some of the basic mechanics, but your skills are really developed just by doing what you do. I have taken a lot of classes, you know, continuing education, learning from people who also make beautiful art with flowers. But more than anything, since I started working at LaSalle, I've never looked back. I've just always had my hands in flowers.
I'm just curious, what were you going to study in college and pulled you away into flowers?
Well, I was at Moody Bible Institute in downtown Chicago. I was studying Bible ed. You know, as an 18-year-old, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And my parents said, if you don't know, do a year at Bible college and then you can figure it out.
And so you got to study Haggai and everything like that. So
yes. And you know what? I was not a good student. I loved flowers. I really didn't love homework. So I can do any kind of homework when it comes to flowers, but when it comes to writing papers, not so much.
Your arrangements always cheer me up and have, you know, like whenever I need a boost, I just have to go look at your arrangements. And I watched your videos, and I have to say, like, as you were doing the demonstration flower arrangement, And you were doing it and it just looks so beautiful. And then you like take out major components because you want to redo it. And I'm going like, no, it's so perfect. And then it just looks so much better too. I mean, they were such beautiful videos that you did.
Well, sometimes with flowers, with arrangements, I think we all, including myself, have a tendency to overstuff. And I try to think of, I think there's a quote from Coco Chanel that I may butcher, but she said, before you leave the house, you should look in the mirror and remove 5 items, which I don't wear a lot of items, so it's hard to remove. But I think of that in flowers, like look at it closely and then remove something so that you can really see the beauty of you know, you can see what you're focusing on.
Right. And you had also said about squinting at it just to get the general shape and stuff. It was like a very informative.
Video. You squint, which gives you some of that negative space. You know, you can see where you have holes that are purposeful and holes that are accidental and fill it in that way.
Friends of mine are Green Trail Farms, you know, and
yes,
so I always
love them.
Oh, I know. They're just so wonderful. And they do these beautiful, exquisite arrangements as well. Mm-hmm. And I always love the ones that have herbs in them or, you know, edibles, even a rosemary or, they're just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Green trails.
It adds so much variety. And I mean, it adds to it because the flowers, some of them don't have an overpowering or even a slight fragrance. And when you put the herbs in there, it just is so delicious smelling.
Right. Right.
That's so, Chris, true. I was going to take you back to LaSalle. How long were you at LaSalle? And then what's your move after that? You know, you were there for X amount of years. And how did that develop with your family and everything?
Yeah. So I was at LaSalle for quite a few years. In fact, I still go back and work for Valentine's Day, helping them out on each Valentine's Day. So I have never left LaSalle in one way. I've been working there since 1995. But when I got married, we had our first child and then second child on the way, early 2000s, and realized we needed to live somewhere other than a third floor walk up in the city. So we found a little place in Indiana, a town where we both went to high school in Chesterton. And I commuted for a tiny bit, you know, took my hours down to part-time, but then really just embraced being a mother. So we very quickly had 4 children and I dove into homeschooling and raising them with beauty. My husband is an English teacher, so he is all about raising them with literature and words. And my children tease me that I'm the arts and crafts homeschool mom. So not super strong on math, but we were great with arts, crafts, and literature.
I know there's wonderful math tutors, so don't even worry about them.
That's exactly it. I felt like I could find the people they needed. But as the children got older, I continued to do flowers just at home or occasionally at LaSalle for Valentine's Day, Mother's Day. But once they reached a certain age, maybe between 5 and 9, I started Sugarfield Flowers, you know, very small, very slow. I joked that it was my secret business for a while because just juggling it all was difficult. And it's just taken off from there, kind of word of mouth, interacting with fellow. I do a lot of weddings, so interacting with fellow wedding vendors, sharing the things that we love, collaborating on stylized things where we can all have as much creativity as we want, has really kind of pushed my business forward. And it's
I think it was very innovative to have to pair with artists for like containers even, you know, or your collaboration with Sunnyside Drive, you know, it's it's just like so beautiful. I mean, to pair a handmade vase with those beautiful flowers.
Oh, I absolutely love collaboration. I'm actually I worked last year and will be working this year with Beale Pottery, which is located in, I think they're Westville now. So we'll be working with Beale Pottery and they'll be making some beautiful, you know, Sugarfield vessels for Mother's Day. And then we'll have some workshops in their brand new studio in the fall and winter. So I'm so excited for that. Just They're amazing potters, and their art is gorgeous. So to get to put both of ours together just makes me so happy.
I know, it's exquisite.
Do you teach anything? Do you teach other people that want to learn about floral design? Is that what you do, or do you even have time for that?
Well, it's funny. So much of our life now is pre-COVID and post-COVID. And pre-COVID, I did quite a few workshops where we would do mainly wreath classes, like in the winter. People love making their Christmas wreaths, fall wreaths. We would do arrangements.
You even did like a
holidays.
Thanksgiving. Didn't you do? You did something special for Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Thanksgiving centerpiece classes. And I love teaching because I love watching people's faces as they realize they can make something beautiful. I think too many people approach flowers and approach art with a bad taste in their mouth because one time in third grade, somebody told them their drawing was bad. And so they decide they're not artists. And I just think as long as you have the mechanics, and of course, some of us are better than others. You know, some of us practice more than others. So I love seeing people realize, oh, if I have the proper mechanics, I can make something gorgeous. And just how confident people leave my classes. So pre-COVID, we're a lot more workshops. Now post-COVID, we are coming back. Like I said, I'll be doing workshops with Beale Pottery. And what I've really wanted this year is a lot more collaboration, like community collaboration. So while I am investing in workshops with the public, I'm also collaborating with fellow florists and fellow farmers, trying to bring more local beauty to the fingertips of my fellow florists. I'm starting something called a flower hub, which is essentially all these local florists want to buy locally from farms that grow in Indiana, much like Green Trail Farm, which I adore. So we are going to have a weekly hub where all our surrounding farms bring in their flowers and florists and flower shops can come and purchase their flowers at wholesale prices. Which to me just builds community. You know, it's good for all of us in that way. So it's a new thing we're trying this year. It's coming up slowly, but I'm very, very excited about it.
Do you still source flowers like from South America? I remember speaking to a guy who actually was a pilot, and he was actually what he did with like an airliner size thing was fly flowers from Colombia back to the States. And that was what he did. So, I mean, do you source flowers from South America still? And
Yes. I source flowers from all over. We have them from my roses come from Ecuador. I purchase quite a bit from Holland. Quite a bit from California. This year, I'm taking baby steps towards sourcing U.S. grown. Flowers are a lot like food, where we are just now coming back around to realizing that locally grown, grown by our own farmers,
seasonal,
has much more life and beauty. Right. Yes. So while I adore the prices of Ecuadorian roses, I'm trying to move towards U.S. grown. So that's a big part of starting a flower hub this year, is supporting the people that surround me, you know, and purchasing and using their beauty.
You can even see it grow to where they're trading, you know, like specialty flower seeds, and everybody grows because of this hub that, you know, you're creating. Oh. There'll be so much sharing.
Yeah, exactly. Because local farms can grow things that just don't ship well. You know, there are certain flowers that if you only buy flowers from Colombia or flowers from Holland, there are certain flowers that do not ship well. And my local farmer can grow them for me, which just brings that extra beauty and that extra movement to my arrangements.
Right. I never know every week what Green Trail Farm is going to have, because they surprise themselves sometimes with what grows.
Right. You know, yeah.
Or what did well this year as opposed to last year. So,
yes.
It's always delightful. You know what I learned from your video, which was so much fun, and I can't believe I didn't think to reflex tulips. You know, that was like, I just feel like I just can't wait to like practice.
Yeah.
It will change like the way the arrangements look so much. So that video is like really wonderful.
Fascinating how many little tricks that we use to make things look more natural, you know?
Chris, now this is, you may not even have the answer to this question, but I'll throw it out there. With climate change, is where flowers are going to be sourced from and grown maybe changing? Are you seeing that yet? Or maybe it hasn't affected the flower industry?
You know, it is starting to affect the flower industry. Basically, like the flooding in California, we've also had a lot of flooding in Florida, which a lot of the country's greenery comes from. You know, almost any kind of fern, ivy comes from Florida. So with flooding, with wildfires, with different things like that, it very much has affected flowers coming from those parts of the country. Not so much climate change, but COVID really affected the global market just because farms didn't have workers, couldn't use their crops. So they ended up destroying crops. Whole farms went under simply because, you know, you can only go so long without selling your product. But climate change is huge in what we're trying to do moving forward. Going back to that flower hub, going back to keeping things a little closer to home. The big problem is education. You know, much like food, we think we should be able to get any kind of flower at any time of the year. Well, strawberries in December don't taste as good as strawberries in June, much like tulips in December or tulips in August aren't as beautiful as tulips in the spring. So we all need to, it's, I think, my job and florist's job to educate people as to what flowers really are and to focus on that ephemeral beauty rather than on demand beauty.
One other question, and this is like asking you, who's your favorite child? Do you have a favorite flower?
Well, they change seasonally.
Yeah.
Yes. In spring, I love all the types of daffodils. And if it's warm enough, the early peonies.
Lily of the Valley.
Lily of the Valley. I think certain flowers, I love them because they are so short-lived.
Yeah.
If you have something that you have to treasure for a week and then it's gone, it just is that much more beautiful. In fall, there's heirloom mums, chrysanthemums that are kind of spidery and weird looking. In the winter, of course, you can force an amaryllis, which I did this winter, and it lasted so long I finally threw it away at the beginning of March because I was like, you know what? I am done with you. I've seen enough amaryllis. But so there's all different kinds, but every season is a special flower.
It's so true, because just that very short period of lilac, you know, you find yourself looking forward to that time when you'll get to smell lilac for a brief amount of time.
Yes. And you wish you could keep it.
Yes.
But it makes it perfect that way.
It does.
So how many events do you do, weddings or other types of things that you do? Like, I mean, I'm looking at your Instagram. I mean, there's lots of things there, but how many do you do a year?
My main focus is weddings, and I do between 40 and 60 a year. We try to keep it to one or two a day on a weekend, but I also do workshops. We'll do maybe three wreaths in the winter. We'll do a couple centerpieces for Thanksgiving. I also like to support locally. So upcoming is the Listen to Your Mother show in Hobart. And so I support them by making florals for the stage, florals for all their cast members. I think that's a wonderful, it's just a wonder. I love going and listening to the stories.
We had Carrie on the show
Yeah, she's fantastic. So that kind of thing I support. Our local high school, you know, the big band bash, we support that. but I keep those are kind of few and far between. I'd say maybe five or six events a year, with my main focus being weddings. This year, the Floral Hub is going to take up a bit of time corralling farmers and florists. But my goal is for the spa to communicate either with our Chesterton Art Center in Chesterton or Lubasnik in Michigan City. And I'd like to bring in Art in Bloom, where florists take a piece of art and recreate it in flowers. Ooh. And it's just a fun show. And I think that would be amazing.
That would be great at the Lubasnik Center because they have that beautiful big gallery.
Mm-hmm. So bring it in regionally because it happens in New York City and, you know, out east on the East Coast, but I think we should bring it to the Midwest.
I think that's a great idea. And of course, Hannah, the executive director of Chesterton Arts Center, would be interested in probably that. So,
we can
chat about that. So that's a great idea. So,
I'll put Janet in contact with you as well with the Lubasnik Center.
So any future expansion plans? Are you thinking of bringing on, is this a one-woman operation for the most part, or is it a family business, or how? Any expansion ideas?
It is a family business in that both my daughters have
flower children
for years. Yes, so they design. My husband and boys, they load, they deliver, but they would prefer not to be forced to make anything. But as the children grow and go away to college, I can't really force them to stay home. So I will be expanding in a small way, but I don't actually want to take over the world with flowers. Right. I want to be able to focus and do beautiful things in my corner of the world. So we'll expand a tiny bit as the children leave. We'll fill their spaces.
Sounds great. Yeah. Well, we have just about 1 minute left, and we want to give you a chance to tell people how they can find you, what if you have any upcoming workshops or events, things like that. So, your social media. So tell us all about how they can find your business.
Well, the best way to find me, I'm online, sugarfieldflowers.com is my website. For updated work on Instagram and Facebook, Sugarfield Flowers again. I sometimes post a lot, sometimes post a little, but that's the best place. On my website.
So how did you decide your name?
It comes from a Walt Whitman poem. And it talks about people hoeing in the sugar field, which I'd imagine is beets, but I prefer to think of it as flowers. So I do love Walt Whitman.
That's great. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air and sharing all about Sugarfield Flowers. You can find it on Instagram, Facebook, and do a great search. That's Chris Livovich, and she's available there. Thank you so much for sharing your journey and your story on Art on the Air.
Yeah, such a happy one. Thank you.
And wonderful. Thanks.
Hey, this is singer-songwriter from the region, Kevin Friend, and you're listening to Art on the Air at Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Thomas Harris to Art on the Air. Thomas is a ceramic artist near Bloomington, Indiana. He uses altered wheel throwing and hand building to make fascinating functional and non-functional work. Deconstructionist in ideation, his forms are brilliantly colored exercises in surface decoration. His business name is Cleo Ceramics. Thank you, Thomas, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome. Hi.
Hi. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you. It's been ages and ages and then more ages.
Right.
Well, Thomas, what we always like to start with our guests is kind of your origin story. We want to know all about you, like your beginnings and everything. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about yourself.
Yeah, well, it's funny because it seems like it's been a long road. I mean, I started wanting to study art in college, and that's actually where I discovered ceramics. Ending up in Northern Arizona University, studying with Don Bendel, who had, a bit of a reputation. So I felt fortunate. But I think after, those 5 years, I actually did go into a master's program, but I had switched into, performance art. So technically, my master's degree is in a separate art field, but I think what that did was expose me to, say, the fissures in between the different traditional art forms. So working in performance art, say, you'd be using your body, which, of course, is not the same as dance and performance. It's right in between the two. And I think maybe that's one of the things that I kept with me as I sort of moved down the road to various different things, and then finally back to ceramics, because there was a lengthy hiatus where I was raising a family and working basically in IT, mostly web server and server maintenance and the like. And about, I don't know, almost 20 years ago now, I sort of woke up one morning and realized that I wanted to be involved in art again. And there just so happens to be a really good program at Indiana University. And so being a staff member at IU meant that I could take free courses. And so I kind of re-educated myself, because the kind of training that I got when I was an undergraduate is completely different than the way that they train ceramic artists now. So instead of Studio 1, 2, 3, and 4, you could go in and you could take slip casting and sculpture and advanced wheel throwing, even history of ceramics. None of those kinds of things existed. So I felt like I got a real, like I said, re-education, also with very top tier artists, which I feel was also very beneficial. They have quite an amazing faculty there. Malcolm Mobutu Smith is still there. Crystal Bogert was there, and a number of other people. Matt Repscher was also an artist in residence or a visiting scholar, and Tim Mather was the head. So I really benefited from that. And then I think easily enough, you know, I kind of felt myself in this dilemma where I had all this work piling up and I didn't really know what to do with it. So I tried different ways of selling it, like a cooperative gallery. And then I started doing art fairs. And really, I have been doing art fairs ever since. So for about the last 20 years, that's been my main focus, which paired fairly well with the fact that I really was still working full time, you know, in IT. But I was actually working full time as an artist at the same time, given the number of art fairs that I was doing. And then it's just a matter of the importance of photographs. You know, with getting into art fairs, they don't usually see your work live. They see photographs of it. So that's where I put a lot of my focus. And so I'm still doing that. I do, during the pandemic, I still have a desire to have, when you submit in your work for an art fair, of course, they're going to jury it. But what I found is that there, even some of the top tier art fairs don't necessarily say, is there a ceramic artist who's a professional who is juring in my work? So one of the things I did during the pandemic is make sure, since all the art fairs were closed, that I got that I applied to a number of national exhibitions that were always juried by very well known ceramic artists. And so I'm trying to work both on, call that for an artist, I'd say that's your resume when you're getting into well known exhibitions, as well as going to art fairs. And I think the thing about these art fairs that I've been going to is I always try to get into better and better art fairs. Is that that provides me with a lot of exposure, and definitely met a lot of people, a lot of contacts there.
Thomas, I want to take you back to like 5 years old. And so did you grow up in an artistic household? What was your elementary school art experience like? I mean, we want to know like where it all started.
I really think that the only exposure that I had in my memory was more like maybe middle school, where I had an older sister who was interested in art and wanted to become an artist. And so that's about the only influence that I can recall. So we're talking about 12 or 13. And so, you know, I did one or two paintings, but I didn't, even though I felt like I kind of joined in on the idea of wanting to be an artist, I didn't really have much motivation to do any kind of work other than, say, find a photograph and then try to do a painting of that. And ironically, it wasn't until I went to a private school, Catholic school, with a kind of a non-existent art program. And then I moved to a public school in my final year, and they had an extensive program. So I got exposure to all of these different forms. So I took painting there and printmaking. I didn't take ceramics, but I mean, you know, I took art classes just that one year, and that's what prompted me to go to study art. And I think when you get into a BFA program, one of the best things about a BFA program is that it basically has you take courses in every different medium. And so, you know, not only printmaking and painting and sculpture, but ceramics as well. And it just seemed to kind of set with me that the there's something very prosaic about throwing, because you're throwing cylinders. And so when you're throwing on the wheel, cylinders are made, and that means functional pieces in general are what people put out. And I would even say that in my 5 years, I studied ceramics literally for 3 years because of a transfer to NAU. But in those 3 years, I would say most of the people and Don Bendel as well were making vessels of one kind or another. And I don't think it was until I moved and started studying more here at IU, where I was exposed to all the multiple facets of the ways that people were using ceramics.
Thomas, from the get-go, because now that I'm listening to you, I can understand where the performance art, I mean, your pieces have a lot of movement in them and you see the work differently. And so as you talk about the painting, because that's what's so unusual about your pieces. I mean, the way you work all of it, not only just the physical form of it, but also the decorative form of it. So from the get-go, were you incorporating all of that in the pieces? Did you see them that way? Or so what were those early functional and sculptural pieces like?
No, I think really what I was doing was working mostly with breaking out of the idea that what I'm making technically on the wheel was a functional thing. And one of the best experiences that I had was with Matt Repscher. He's an artist out of Santa Fe who was at IU for a couple of years. And his advanced technique class would have us just do things like where you're throwing on the wheel. But when he would demonstrate, he'd say, okay, you're going to make a series of letters that you're going to throw on the wheel. Well, how do you make a letter A if you're throwing on the wheel, right? Got that hole in the middle and you know, the two legs. And he would do these demonstrations where he'd be throwing something. And he didn't say, you know, the idea of what is a quality work that's being thrown is very different if it's a functional piece versus a sculptural piece. If your intent isn't to make it functional. And so he would throw something and, you know, it might have 20 pounds on the wheel, and he would throw it halfway. Then he would cut it off and he would turn it upside down and shape it in various ways. And so it helped me to see that, you know, I didn't have to have, you know, here's my hammer and there's my nail, right? And if all you have is a hammer, then everything else is a nail. It became a tool which allowed for a lot more flexibility. And I think that's how I like the idea of creating forms on the wheel. There's something definitely very contemplative. It's an element of practice, right? I will be throwing something, and then that piece is just a thrown object. Like the thrown piece is the canvas, because I haven't done anything with it, because that thrown shape is not the shape that I'm going to end up with.
Right.
I'm going to cut it. I'm going to fold it. I'm going to put some surface decoration. There are steps in ceramics I suppose you could avoid, but I mean, you have the basic element of taking the clay and making it in a wet format, and then drying it, and then putting it in the kiln, and then bisque firing it. At least the standard approach is what I do. And then once you bisque fire it, then you apply the surface decoration. So there's almost a necessary separation between form and surface decoration.
So
there's a lot of, for me, observation. How do I match the appropriate surface decoration to the way that I'm creating my pieces?
Well, and also, your functional pieces are really sculptural pieces, you know, like I'm thinking about the mug. I mean, yes, you can drink from it, but it is just such an exquisite piece that you've created. I mean, your surface decoration, I wish we had See a Vision right now, See a Radio program, because your surface decoration is like phenomenal. I mean, you can't even believe that it's ceramics, you know. It's just so beautiful. And
well,
then the actual
you.
Form, the way that you have changed that basic mug form into a piece of sculpture, it's just, wow. I want everybody to look up your work.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. But you can at clayo.com, right? CLAOH.com, and you can see what we're talking about.
So I would love for you to go into a bit how you developed your layered sanding. I mean, like the process, it just seems, it's just amazing to me.
Well, I think that even after finishing the studies, what happens is that there's still a thirst for knowledge, you know, and I think of in past centuries where I lived in Paris for a couple of years and have been to the Louvre. And one of the things that I found very striking was that during the 18th and 19th century, artists would go and set their easels up in front of these paintings, and then they would copy them verbatim. Well, some of these artists were very famous. And, you know, after they went through the process of copying the masters, they came up with their own vocabulary. And I think that that's exactly the route that I have followed, which means I see from wherever, you know, it could be Ceramics Magazine, because I always get that, as well as all of the resources that are online, things that I'm exposed to, there'll be something that will capture my eye and I'll go, what is that? What did this person do? And I think ceramic artists are very generous with their information.
Yes.
And I've had exposure to some of these techniques that people have used, and I have used them. Like Jen Schwarzkopf is a fairly well-known current artist who uses she creates wheel thrown forms and then she adds pieces onto them. Well, I would have to credit her at least in part to the fact that I'm using additive altered pieces in a ceramic format. You know, and I would even credit Matt Repscher again because of an exercise that he gave me when I was taking his class, where he wanted us to make something like 30 cups. Well, or cups or mugs. And after you've made 30 of them, you know, you're like, okay, how do I make this one different? How do I make that one different? Well, he took out of all 30 that I had on the table, he picked one up and he held it. And it was a teacup that I had done one simple cut and fold, and then looped a handle on it. And he held it, and he just looked at me, and he goes, "This is the one, right here." And so, I think even that kind of feedback, you know, which is his way of saying, "Now this is a thing that you need to pursue," because he says, "This is the one." Well, I still make that form. I'll tell you right now, I have that. I kept that very piece. And it looks like from another era, but I do that same teacup form where I have a shallow teacup and then cut it and fold it and loop the handle The surface decoration is completely different, though. So yeah, that was my first cut and my first fold. But I feel like my vocabulary is centered around wheel throwing and altering, sometimes additive progression. You know, because you're when you're throwing, you know, I don't just throw one. I there's a shape, and you know, I'm also running a business, which means I'm selling them. So if it's, I have to make 10 of it at a time or 20 at a time, but if I make 10 at a time, by the time I get to 8, I'm interested in making other things, you know, because right. I've been sitting there and watching myself do this thing, because you're just looking down on the wheel and you're seeing the shape, and it's almost like an intuition. It's not a decision that says, oh, you need to do this, but it's kind of like, well, what if I did this? And, you know, I have the freedom to make change because clay is cheap. So, and I will do the same with surface decoration as well.
You know, one of the pieces I loved watching is and looking at is, like, they call them Dubai the Dragon, and one of the other ones, I guess, some sort of gargoyle. You have two examples on your website of that, which really is a sculpture that hangs on the wall. So tell us about developing those pieces. I mean, those are just, most people think about ceramics of being like bowls, cups, things like that. These are really sculptures that hang on your wall.
Well, they are, and the interesting thing is I consider them functional. Because that's essentially what gargoyles are, right? They were initially meant to be put on the side of the house and to take water away. And of course, we don't really need to do that anymore. But those pieces are hand built, and I'm not really sure why I started to do that. But I felt like after making, I'm sure I've made 100 of them. I got more interested in where I wanted to go next. And the first one I did was Montepulciano, and that was a dragon-type shape, which has medieval buildings, and it just happened to be a place that I rode my bike through when I was touring in France. And so I just liked that idea of you've got one juxtaposition of one size with another, because, you know, if you've got a fantastical creature, but then, you know, the population populating his head, so to speak, with buildings where you would normally find, I don't know, ears and other Ice. Aspects that might be. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I found those pieces absolutely fascinating. And what you comment on your website is where art lives. And it shows, I think, one of the pictures you didn't get for several years from the customer finally got one to you about where they actually placed your gargoyle dragon character.
Right.
I know the most comments I get is that people can't believe that they're actually glazes. They think that you've spray painted these pieces because of the intricacy and the delicacy of the colors.
Well, the gargoyles are the reason that I have that layered, multiple layers of underglazes that are sanded, which is probably what you're referring to.
Yes.
And that was a technique that I saw a video of some guy trying, you know, on his teapots what he was doing. And so I went ahead and started to use that on my gargoyles because I felt like that was, to me, like a patina. So I have to credit my gargoyles as where I started to use the standard surfaces, which now has sort of bled into the rest of my work. I'm still really focused on, you know, that's a very dry surface, painterly surface is what a lot of people have told me, because you have the throw lines. And of course that gives it direction, and that yes. direction of the throw lines will enhance the direction of the pieces as I cut them and the implication of the spiraling. But in addition, I'm using more contrasting, like I've been doing crystalline glazes to contrast with that very dry surface.
Oh, beautiful. So how can people view your work?
I have work on Etsy. So Etsy.com. And I guess the best contact is clayo.com. And then you'll see a button there, you know, contact and buy, you know, which will list the art fairs that I will be going to. Indiana Artisan is going to be the first one, and that's in 3 weeks from now, so April 1st. And I kind of go quite around the Midwest, Michigan and Minneapolis, Asheville, South Carolina, Atlanta, Kansas City. So there will be a list of art fairs that I'll be at, as well as the online stores that I use.
Well, we only have a minute left. Is there any, do you ever do any gallery style exhibits besides doing the type of art fairs or anything like that? Or are you into that at all?
Well, yeah, I do. Like I said, I really like doing exhibitions, and getting into exhibitions means that I will send one piece someplace. So in the last couple of years, probably the biggest show that I've been, that I've gotten into twice is the Strictly Functional Pottery National, which is a really big show in Pennsylvania. I also have work in a gallery here in Bloomington, because I'd really like to have, you know, some kind of a presence in my local town.
Very good. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's Thomas Harris. While he calls himself a ceramicist, I really almost admire your work as a sculptor, because it really shows the functional and non-functional works. We'd like to thank you for coming on Art of the Air. You can find him at clayo, that's clayoh.com, and you can find out more about his work, view it, and everything. Like Thomas, thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, Thomas. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org, and Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on WDSO 88.3 FM. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Art in the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio: Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good, and you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your